Hi, this is Christopher Perrin with Inside Classical Education. On this podcast program, I interview a variety of leaders, administrators, and educators on topics relating to classical Christian education and its ongoing recovery and renewal in the 21st century. Archives of previous interviews can be found at our blog and podcast site at www.insideclassicaled.com. This is Christopher Perrin. I'm here with Mark Guthrie, who is the head of school at Caldwell Academy in Greensboro, North Carolina, a school of about 800 students. Mark has served at Caldwell Academy for the past 7 years. Prior to that, he worked at the International School in Lyon, France. Mark's going to share with us his vision and passion for classical Christian education, and he's also going to do that by means of telling us a story about a marathon that he ran in about the year 2000. It's quite a story, and it serves as a kind of metaphor for what he's seeking to do at Caldwell Academy. Mark, thanks for joining with us.
I'm honored to be here, Chris. Thank you for having me, and excited to share any wisdom that I learned from my experience.
When did you first think you were going to run a marathon?
It was about 1999, and my thought process was I always encouraged an education at that point about 10 years, and I've always encouraged my students to set goals and objectives and set them a little higher than they think they can get, they can obtain, and then pursue them. And I thought, you know, in my own life, I don't really have great examples of doing that. And so I was in Atlanta, Georgia at the time and thought, well, I've never run a 26.2-mile race. I could set that as my goal and then pursue it and try to accomplish it and see what happens.
So did you run your first race in 1999 then?
This marathon I ran was in 2000. It was in November of 2000.
Okay. Well, before we get to your racing history, tell us a little bit about how you got into education and how you ended up serving as head of school at Caldwell Academy.
Well, education for me has been a passion from the very beginning. I was not one that changed my major in college or anything like that. My major was mathematics education. I graduated with that degree, then went for my master's degree in straight mathematics, but it was to pursue, again, a mathematics teaching position. And then I got my specialist degree, my master's plus 30, in educational administration and supervision. I love kids. I'm in the process right now, in fact, waiting for the call, even as I'm talking to you, from Uganda, of adopting two children. And so maybe even by this weekend I will be in Uganda, hopefully, my family, if the Lord allows, to expand our family with two more here. And so I've always had a passion for students, and so for me education was a very natural draw. Both my parents are professors. My father is the head of a math department. My mother's an English professor. And so I definitely was reared in an educational family. And and so I have literally for 21 years now smiled every time I've gone to work and never felt like it was a pain. There are good and bad days, but I've enjoyed it absolutely thoroughly. And even now as a head of school, I still coach our boys' varsity soccer team. Still try to be very involved, hands-on. I just came from a round table just a few minutes ago with our junior class, discussing various issues and debating propositional statements, and it's the highlight of my day. I moved into administration around 2000. It's when I finished my degree. I moved to Lyon, France, where I served as the director of the American School of Lyon for a few years. And then I heard about Caldwell Academy in France, actually, and heard it had a great reputation and really a neat school and a classical Christian school and seemed to be doing things well. And so I interviewed here and just hit it off immediately. The board was incredible and a wonderful praying board. And so in 2004, I moved here and took over the head of school job. And this is my seventh year here. So it's been, and it's just been, again, it's been a wonderful fit for my family and me. And we have thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed being part of this institution.
Hmm. It sounds, Mark, as if your love for kids would lead you to think that education is not just about exams and classroom lectures. It sounds to me like you think of the whole student when you think about education, if you love kids the way you do. Could you describe the way in which you seek to have students formed, fully formed, and equipped to serve the church and the culture as a result of going through Caldwell?
That's a great question. Every other day here at Caldwell, I meet with prospective parents, group of about maybe 10 to 12 that come through and they tour, and most of them kindergarten parents, but a number, kindergarten through 12. And then I sit down with them for an hour and we just talk, and everything's on the table. I mean, these are their children, these are their world. And so I realized that, and what an honor that they would consider letting you partner with them in probably the highest calling they'll have here on the earth. And so I just say, everything's on the table. What do you want to talk about? And invariably, the questions will come up about maybe AP courses or even more, what colleges can my children get into because they go to Caldwell Academy? How is that going to help me get into Harvard or Yale or Duke? Or here around here, it's Duke, North Carolina, mm-hmm. Wake Forest. Mm-hmm. I always respond the same way. I say, boy, that is a great question, but I think there's a better one. I'd love to brag about our kids and where they go, and normally they get their first choice, and that's all great. Mm-hmm. But if you'd let me rephrase the question, I would love to answer who our graduates are. Because I think that's so much more important than where they're going to college. Mm-hmm. College is a very limited part of what we're trying to prepare our students to accomplish. Mm-hmm. And that is, if you have the idea that you are trying, biblically you would say thoroughly equipped for every good work, mm-hmm. Then it's much, much broader and more difficult, really, to give them the tools to be thoroughly equipped for every good work, for whatever God calls them to do, which can be really, literally thousands of mm-hmm. occupations and anywhere in the continent, and learning under all types of different systems and whatever the Lord has for them. Well, then your job it has to go way beyond making them good memorizers, mm-hmm. making them able to understand a professor enough that they can parrot back on exams what they believe that professor wants well enough to get their A to be able to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
And so we try to convince our students that there's more that to life and hopefully get them to buy into the idea of becoming fully alive and really making, you're developing a different type of graduate. Other people may say we have smart graduates. We would say our graduates are great learners. I think the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. We start there. But we want to make sure that our students are Renaissance men and women. And that's much more important to us than, again, just focusing on can we get them into whatever, by what standard are we going, whatever college, great college, quote-unquote, they may want to attend. And so, the bottom line for that is giving them tools, starting in kindergarten all the way through 12th grade, that enable them to acquire the knowledge, to process well, to communicate effectively, mm-hmm. and to practice continually on these subjects that we throw at them. and so we are trying. We believe that enables them to be a very different type of graduate. And we see that there's proof in the pudding. We see it. We're young. This is our 16th year. Mm-hmm. But the school has grown to almost 800 kids. Mm-hmm. We stopped the growth because the demand has been wonderful. But our graduates have been extremely successful. They have gone to all kinds of universities or the mission fields or, military or wherever else, but they've been successful. Mm-hmm. They're not just sitting in classes. They're running for student body president. They're they're speaking in classes. They'll call us and say, I'm in a class of 300. A lecture class, they're talking philosophy, nobody's saying anything, And our students have had philosophy. They've read the great books, so they're engaged in the great conversation, and they're the only ones, you know, they're bantering back and forth with the professors. That's exciting to us because they are fighting in the realm of ideas. And we tell them, we want you to have that, we want you to fight as hard in the area of ideas that you do on a soccer field or a basketball court or whatever else when you're scrambling after that ball. And so that's what we're trying to develop, is truly thoroughly equip them to be Christian Renaissance men and women.
You mentioned this phrase, fully alive.
Right.
And I've heard others quoting this well. I think it might come from Irenaeus, the glory of God is a man fully alive. Is that what you were alluding to?
That's exactly right.
I would say maybe 15 years ago, that kind of talk in the classical Christian renewal movement wasn't that common.
Right.
And you've just highlighted the idea of a graduate that is fully formed and fully equipped for every good work that transcends the classroom, although academics is vitally important and includes character and virtue. And couldn't help noticing on your website that you have a graduate profile that describes in about one paragraph what you've unpacked for us so well. How do parents respond when you share this finish line that you're imagining for students when you're in your office having this no holds barred conversation? How do they respond when you rephrase the question and share this vision?
Well, I think very favorably. I think you have to, especially at that moment, you're trying to figure out if your school is a good partner for their home and their family. And you have to get to the objective of your school and the objective of their home and see if they match. Mm-hmm. And the objective of our school, and I believe every classical Christian school that I know, is wisdom and virtue. Mm-hmm. That's our objective, not necessarily a certain particular college or a certain AP course or whatever. But it is truly wisdom and virtue. And so the reason we developed a graduate profile was to try to flesh that out. Wisdom and virtue sounds great to anyone, but what does that really look like in a graduate? You have to have a finish line, and you have to say, how do you know when you're handing a diploma whether you've been truly successful? And so we developed a profile of a graduate, and we had a community-wide information meeting last week, and maybe 100 or so people came, and so we gave it to every one of them. And that was the first thing, is they sat down, because for one, it lets them know immediately who we are, and that may be a deal killer for them, or it may be a deal maker for them, but either way, they know early, and it's not something where they're questioning, and then they get frustrated in a classroom because we're trying to do teach a certain way, or we have a certain belief. It's right there in front of them, and so it makes it very clear, again, fleshes out what our objective is from kindergarten through 12th grade. Everything should flow into this profile, and the profile should be based upon your mission. And so if that's the case, everybody works hard, if you have this kind of profile and mission, everybody knows that when they're rowing hard, they're also rowing the same direction. And so I think that's very winsome to the parents to know that they know the objective clearly. They know who we are. They know that our desire ultimately is to partner with them, because God's great promise in Proverbs to train up a child in a way he should go, and when he's old he won't depart from it, is a promise to parents directly, not to institutions like our schools. And so we have to keep ourselves in perspective and realize we're probably tertiary. We're you have a family. Many people have their church, which is ordained by God for certain matters, and then you have a school. So we tell them from the first meeting we want to be the strongest third place that we can possibly be in their lives. And so again, when they're trusting their children to you, I think they need to know early on who you are. They need to know the fact that who is in front of the teacher that's in front of their student really does matter. I mean, in grammar school, they actually believe their teachers. So you better know their worldview. In dialectic school, they want to argue with the teachers. And so, again, we teach them, in that middle school years, how to argue and how to argue with respect, how to know your audience, and formal logic, and how to think, which is a dying art. And then obviously in rhetoric, they want to communicate. They want to express themselves. Look at any high school across the nation, and it's all kinds of different kids trying to so badly to express themselves. Mm-hmm. And so, again, that's ultimately wisdom. It's the ability to do things as God would intend you to do them. Mm-hmm. And so we want to do everything we can to give them forms of communication that will make them more like their maker. And so that's ultimately our goal, and we want to say that from the very beginning. And so hopefully it answers their question as to can they get in great colleges. Well, you know, I think we need to define great, but they can really get in any college that they choose. Mm-hmm. But again, we're preparing them for something so much more. And if you look at the profile, it doesn't mention any college or university. Mm-hmm. It really mentions a life that's worth living. Hmm. And so that's what we are. You know, our goal is to make sure that we prepare our students for that life.
Hmm. You know, as you've been talking, Mark, you've used a number of metaphors and analogies to describe what you're endeavoring to do there at Caldwell, and no doubt you running a marathon recently was also a kind of metaphor for what you do personally as the head of school and for the larger classical education endeavor. Tell us about that race and what you learned and why it became kind of a metaphor for what you're doing as an educator and what Caldwell's trying to do.
Well, I'm happy to tell you about the race. There's if you've heard this story before, it's the same one, I can assure you, because I certainly have not run one since then. And so that was my one and only, and I knew that going in. And so I was in Atlanta, Georgia, and I started training for this race. I was going to run it. I went to Ohio State for all my graduate work, the Ohio State University. I need to put that in appropriate terms there. And so I thought what I will do is I'll drive up to Columbus, Ohio, and run the Columbus Marathon in November of 2000. It's fairly flat. It goes through Ohio State. All, you know, all the memories, all these things motivate me and keep me going. And so that was my plan. And so I began training several months ahead, and I trained to the point where I could run 17 miles. Now, I realize it's 26.2 miles, but my thought process was, well, my adrenaline and my momentum will carry me the last 9.2. And so that I was thoroughly convinced of that. If I can get to 17, I can get to 26.
Did you read that in some book, Mark, or was this
never? That was my own.
Your own training regimen?
Formal logic, apparently, when I was growing up. And so that was my own reasoning. And I just thought, you know, if I can get to this point, I'm sure I can get to this point.
The Guthrie Marathon Manual.
Yes. I broke every rule from the Marathon Manual, I can assure you. And so I broke a lot of rules, actually, from the Marathon Manual, I believe. So I trained that far. I got in my car, drove to Columbus, Ohio, in time to be on at the starting line. 7 a.m., and we took off running, and I was thrilled. I was excited. Mm-hmm. I had to run. Not only did I want to run a marathon, I wanted to run it in 4 hours or less, mm-hmm. because I knew I was only going to run one. Mm-hmm. So I knew this wasn't going to be something that I could work my way to. I just wanted to say my first one, just go kill yourself, get done, and get below 4 hours, and you've accomplished your objectives, mm-hmm. And now you set this goal. Was higher than you thought you could do, you know, and it was a something that you could share with students and things like that. So that was my objective. And so basically you have to run about an 8.5 minute mile for 26.2 miles. Mm. And so I took off running, and I felt great, Chris. I mean, I just felt great. Adrenaline was pumping. Mm. And so my first, really my first 18 miles, I ran 8 minute mile. I mean, I was just cruising. Yeah. When I took off the start, I was so excited. The Ohio State band was playing, and I stopped and I danced with the tuba player from the Ohio State band. And about a mile later, all the Buckeye cheerleaders were out there, and so I went through right in the middle of them and high-fived them all. I was screaming and yelling. There were really nice area of Columbus, and you had all these very wealthy homes, and the people were out on their lawns with their servants serving them breakfast. And I was running up on the lawns, waving at them, and just completely out of my mind on adrenaline, really, and just cruising. And I felt great, and again, that really continued. I thought, boy, I am just going to crush this marathon. And that continued till mile 18. Mm. And at that point, literally everything changed for me. Mm. I mean, everything. I remember the first thing I noticed was the crowd started going blurry. And I thought, that's not right. And then my balance started, instead of running forward, my body started turning a little bit to the left. Mm. And so I was running almost sideways. I couldn't get my feet straightened out anymore. And so it was not only embarrassing, it was very physically draining because I'm running sideways now. And I knew I had over 8 miles to go. And so I start getting slower and slower and slower. And it's getting worse because I'm emotionally drained as well. Mm. I'm physically drained. I guess many marathoners carry little packets of gels mm-hmm. or something like that. Mm-hmm. They eat things along the way. Well, I certainly didn't have anything for that. And so it was I was starving in a way. My body was completely broken down, and I was starting to cry because emotionally I was just drained. I didn't know anybody. I was doing this completely on my own. My family was still back in Atlanta. So it was getting to the point where it was overwhelming to me. And the good news was another gentleman was struggling as badly as I was. And so he and I were running together for a little bit. And it was my only solace because we were getting passed so fast by everyone that it was really disheartening. And about mile 21... this guy that I was running with, we were crossing a road, and the police had stopped all traffic, and they were standing out in the middle of the road, and the guy grabbed the police officer, and both of them hit the ground. I can still picture it so well. The police officer was as shocked as any man I've ever seen. Man grabs them. They both hit the ground together, and all I hear from the man was, "I'm done," and that's it. I was so close, Chris, at that point. I mean, I can't tell you to just fall like right on top of the two of them and just say, "Me too." I mean, it's exactly, I had nothing left at that point. And here the one man that was struggling as badly as I had just quit.
Sometimes you hear that at this point in a race for some who are struggling this way, that everything is screaming within to just stop. Did you have that kind of experience where you were just, your body, your mind, everything was saying it's going to be so much better if you would just stop right now? How did that work?
Well, I thought I was going to die. I mean, I really did. I had pictured in my mind, I was trying to think how they were getting my body back to Atlanta because I was everything hurt so badly that I thought, weird things, my biceps were killing me. Just from my arms going back and forth and back and forth. Everything from my toes all the way up literally to my neck, which is just, like you said, just screaming. And again, emotionally, I was crying. And so that doesn't help your breathing or anything like that either.
No more high fives.
What's that?
No more high fives.
No high fives. I couldn't get my arms high enough. It would have to be a very low five at that point, and I was running a very direct route. I also thought, your mind's funny. I thought the race officials were playing tricks on us. I was convinced that they had moved the mile markers because it seemed the mile markers, when I was doing well, it seemed to come so quickly. And I thought, that's a half marathon? This is unbelievable. I am just cruising. And then it got to be where instead of running an 8-minute mile, it was 8.5, then 9, then 9.5, 10, 10.5, all the way to about a 13-minute mile, which is not real strong. But I was convinced that they had, that there was a joke. There was a joke going on, and so again, my mind was as tired as everything else, and I thought, this is cruel. I mean, I really was angry with the officials because I didn't think I thought it was not funny. I thought it was just cruel what they were doing. And so really at mile 21, there was a crisis of belief literally at that point of, am I going on? There's 5 more miles. There's just nothing left in the tank. I mean, just nothing. There was no adrenaline for sure. I used my adrenaline really early.
Yeah, that was when you were high-fiving the cheerleaders.
When I was high-fiving the cheerleaders, that was the peak of the adrenaline, I think. And so It was a there was absolutely nothing there, nothing left, and so he fell over, and I pushed on, but now it was more of a I mean, I can't say it was a run because I mean any jog would have been a lot faster than I was going. It was more of kind of a weird paced walk because I was almost completely sideways at this point, and I was querying, just blubbering, crying, trying to push my arms forward. Like I said, everything was blurry. I couldn't focus on anything. And I thought this could be it. I'm not sure this was a great idea. And I remember about that point, just after this man had fallen over, and I'm just pushing through and almost to mile 22, and a man steps out of a crowd. And again, I can't be an easier target at this point. Everybody's racing by me. I'm completely sideways. I'm pretty pathetic at this point. I'm struggling. And the man steps out of the crowd, and he looks right at me, and he screams, much to the delight of the crowd, he screams, "Hey, buddy, they give you your hair back at the end." So I guess you can know by now that I don't have a whole lot of hair. And I still remember my thoughts. Well, I won't say my thoughts because we're on tape. But I was just dumbfounded that the man would pick on me. I mean, I was so, I thought, how horrid can you be to pick on a guy in this kind of condition? And so I couldn't do much about it because my head was all completely down, my arms were barely moving, but I was just devastated that somebody would mock me in this condition. And so I pressed on, and about a half mile later, a little boy steps out of the crowd and he's eating Oreos. And he took his right arm and he just fired one at me. He threw an Oreo at the little slow crying bald man. And I still remember I caught that thing.
You caught it?
I caught it with my right hand.
Well, that's remarkable.
And I stuck it in my mouth. And that was my only food for 26.2 miles was that boy's Oreo. And so it was, again, I have no idea why some boy's mother let him fire an Oreo at the pathetic bald man that's doing some sort of weird walk, down the road. But I guess all in all, at least gave me something to put in my body. Huh. And so about that time, Chris, a lady came jogging up and said, asked me my name, and I could barely sputter out Mark. I mean, I had nothing left. And she said, how many marathons have you run? One, is it? And she said, "Oh, you're doing great." And I said, "It's my last." And she said, "Oh, everybody says that." And I said, no, last." And she tried to talk me and just encourage me. But it got to the point, I mean, she was losing the battle. And so eventually she had planned at that point to try to run in the rest of the way or whatever with me. But that, I mean, she just took off. She left me hanging at that point in my misery. And so that's what made it, again, even more spectacular for what happened next. This man comes running up. He's a lot leaner and meaner than I. He's obviously done many of these before. He was in a great shape. And he asked me the same thing. He says, "What's your name?" And I sputter out Mark. And he says, "How many marathons have you run?" I said, "First." And he said, "Oh, you're doing great." And I said, "Last." And he said, "Oh, everybody says that." And I said, "No, for real." And he said, so he ran with me for a little bit. And then he kept looking at me, and he said, he goes, "Why are you crying, Mark?" And because I was blubbering by that point. And I pointed to a clock, and he said, "Okay." And I said, "4 hours." And he goes, "Oh, you're trying to finish the marathon in 4 hours." And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Okay." And so he looks at me. He looks at the clock again. We're about mile 23, and the clock is definitely working against me. There's absolutely no hope unless I just take off running hard at this point, which I had nothing in me of breaking 4 hours. And so, and he's running backwards at this point, which isn't hard for him. It was just kind of a, you know, I was barely moving. And he said, okay, I tell you what. He said, we're going to do this together. And I wasn't, the lady had told me the same thing, so I wasn't, incredulous here. I didn't really believe him. And he said, we're gonna break 4 hours and we're gonna do it together. And I didn't say anything. I just kept my little whatever going. So he said, I'll be right back. And so he runs about 100 yards in front of us, and I can still see him. And now I don't know anybody in the crowd. I'm doing this all of this on my own. This is my one goal. I wanted to just try to accomplish it all on my own. The crowd has grown because it's the last three and a half miles of the marathon. And he screams to the crowd. He says, hey, everybody. And he points back to me. That was pretty obvious. He goes, this is Mark. It's his first marathon, and he's trying to break 4 hours. Let's get behind him. Well, everybody turns, and they see me. Barely moving, and they look at the clock, and they just start screaming, and they start chanting my name. And so all of a sudden, here I am running, and I look up, and I see these hundreds of people that are screaming, and they all have signs. Now, their signs obviously were for someone else, but I still remember one boy that looked just like my son running in front of me and waving a sign, and it said, I love my daddy. And I said...
You started crying for another reason.
And I thought, that boy loves me, and I'm his daddy. I was just... And then, I mean, people waving all their signs, we love you, honey, go, run. You know, whatever the name is, run. You're the. We believe in you. All this stuff.
It was all for you.
All for me. All for me at that point. And so I was completely overwhelmed. And I will tell you what it did. It took something that I had no idea was inside me, and it really ramped it up. And so all of a sudden, I was still running sideways, and I was still crying, and I looked pretty bad. But I tell you, my everything changed for me. And so I run that next 100 yards in a these people love me. They're chanting and screaming my name. Well, while they were doing that, this man ran around the next corner and did the exact same thing to the crowd, who's wondering what's happening because they're hearing this roar. And so he says, hey, everybody, it's Mark. He's coming around the corner. It's his first marathon. And he's trying to break 4 hours. Let's get behind him. And so, again, I come around this corner, and the whole place erupts.
Oh, my God.
And I look up, and I see just literally all of these fans who are there for other people just screaming my name. They were running next to me. They were saying, you can do it. They were, again, it was just unbelievable. And so, again, for that next 100, 150 yards, my pace, I just was, you know, I just, there was something in there that just responded to all of this support. And this man does this the entire next 3 miles.
Wow.
And so I am overwhelmed because here we are finally coming toward the end. And my pace, you know, has increased because every turn, I'm just, everybody's screaming my name and saying, you can make it, you can make it, you can make it. And so I'm really now pressing, and I'm pushing forward. And I still remember coming around the final turn, and it's 0.2 of a mile. I finally see a finish line. It's 0.2 of a mile away. And I look up at the clock, and the clock was somewhere right at around 3 hours, 55 minutes. And I'm thinking, you know, it was still in doubt because I thought at any moment, you know,
they'll move the markers back.
Right, that's exactly right. I could freeze, and ironically enough, there was a man standing about 100 yards in front of me, and he was completely frozen up. And he was one of the runners, and he was just staring at the finish line, and he was just standing, just frozen there. And I really, my mind flashed to you know, the Columbus Dispatch front page of the next day, seeing the two of us just standing there, you know, a couple hundred yards from the finish line, just leaning, frozen up, because I thought, you know, that there, but by the grace of God, goes me. And so I still remember his face as I passed him. He was the only man I passed in the last 8.5 miles of that run. And he was, of course, horrified to see a man in my condition passing him. But he had just completely, he had nothing. He was just standing. And so, you know, I kind of looked at him as I passed my sideways running, and just glanced up at him and saw how bad of a condition he was in. And now the whole place is just screaming and yelling, and it's just pandemonium. And I'm coming toward that finish line. And I see it, and I just, everything I gave, you know, my arms are pumping, everything's flailing, and I go, I cross the finish line. You have a little chip in your shoe or whatever they put in your shoestrings. Mm-hmm. So it goes off, and it's 3 hours, 56 minutes, and some seconds. I don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. And I am just a basket case at this point. Mm-hmm. And just, I'm just completely weeping. Everybody's screaming. Mm-hmm. I have no idea where the man went. I never saw him again. I've still never seen him to this day.
Oh, interesting.
So no idea. And this lady comes up, a young lady, and she puts some sort of blanket on you. I don't know. I just pushed that off. I wasn't cold. And then she put a medal around my neck. And I grabbed the lady. I was completely delirious. I grabbed her, and I picked her up off the ground, and I picked her up over my head. She wasn't a very big lady, and I shook her with all my might, and I still remember, her stunned look of, this man, I have her in this death grip, and I'm just shaking her, and she's looking at me, and I said, I don't know what to do, and I'm holding her up in the air, and she looks at me so sweetly, and I just, again, I remember the peaceful look on her face, and she said, "You won. You won." And I remember when I put her down, I thought, you know, I didn't win the race. There were some Kenyans that...
they were already back. They were already back in Kenya.
They were probably most of the way back to their country by now.
That's right.
You know, they were at least over the water, that had won the $25,000 prize money, and, you know, they had won, you know, hours before. And so I didn't win that race. But what always stuck with me, Chris, is I won my race. Mm-hmm. I won my race, and that was what she was trying to say. You won. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, was a tremendous parallel with my life. It reminded me so much of C.S. Lewis in his Chronicles of Narnia series, where Aslan's always trying to remind people, that's not your story. Mm-hmm. That's not your story. That's their story. Mm-hmm. I'm dealing with them and their story. Mm-hmm. You need to worry about your story. Run your race. And that's what you need to be concerned with, mm-hmm. And so that has been so poignant for me, even 10 years out from there, mm-hmm. is the just idea of seeing her face and saying you won, and craving the same at some point for the Lord, mm-hmm. from the Lord, mm-hmm. to say the same one day and just look at me and say you won. Mm-hmm. And so that's one parallel that I've always just clung to, mm-hmm. is the desire for that to happen at the ultimate race, at the end of the ultimate race.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I'm thinking of that passage in Hebrews 12. I'm sure you've meditated on that a good bit. The cloud of witnesses.
No question. It matters so much. You know, I tell our teachers every we gather every morning to pray in the mornings, but the first morning before the kids are there, and this is in August, and all the teachers are nervous. You can almost hear their hearts pounding, and the footsteps in the halls aren't quite there yet, and the kids that are there are still waiting to be let in the front door, and you're thinking, okay, you have almost 800 kids waiting to walk in the door, and I say, I want you to be still and hear something, and I always remind them of that passage from Hebrews 12, of the great crowd of witnesses. And I said, you have thousands of Christian school teachers, literally, that are at the corridors of heaven right now, screaming for you as you press forward and saying, it is so worth it. what you're doing. So worth it that you're, especially in this Christian education, and we believe the classical part of that is the best manner in which to prepare these kids for the life that God's called them to live. And so, you know, you have these witnesses that are letting you know we've run it. Mm-hmm. The proof is in the pudding, and the race was so worth it, and you have no idea what the reward's going to be. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody yet, Chris, has seen God in the Bible and said, yes, that's just what I thought. Mm-hmm. Every one of them has hit the ground and said, if I'd only known, I spoke as a fool. Mm-hmm. And so that's always my prayer for myself is, God, give me that glimpse that I live my life now in that kind of light, mm-hmm. rather than waiting till that moment to say, boy, I would have lived differently if I just had a glimpse of who you were. Mm-hmm. And so that's so encouraging. You know, our teachers are always encouraged by that. And then every year when they walk out, the seniors, and they do this on their own, our seniors, we have about 60 a year, and they all are lined the walkway when they walk out. Mm-hmm. And they scream for them and yell for them. And a lot of them have been here all 13 years. And so they, you know, they're patting them on the back. Some of them have notes for the teachers. Mm-hmm. And it's just so neat because just like it did for me, it helps them get to the finish line to have the crowd that's cheering for them even at the beginning.
Now, who's lined up? The teachers are lined up cheering or the students are lined up cheering?
The seniors from our school.
So they cheer the teachers.
Early. Mm-hmm. That morning. And so when our teachers are all coming out of our lunchroom where we pray, all of a sudden you'll hear this big roar go up, and the seniors are all screaming for them and cheering them on, a lot of which, you know, even kindergarten teachers, first, second grade, who had those kids many, many years ago. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of times the seniors will pass notes to the teachers as they pass.
So you have the students sometimes being the cheering crowd.
That's right.
And of course, the teachers are also those cheering as well.
And usually the teachers are the ones that are in the role of I believe in you and you can do it.
But it's wonderful to see that it's really a mutual encouraging cheer that we cry out for one another.
And it's needed. All of us need it. And all of us are in times of our lives where sometimes your role is the one that I had of I'm desperate, and I need someone to come around me, mm-hmm. and be convinced that I can do what I'm attempting to do. Mm-hmm. And every student needs that at some point.
Yes.
Every student needs that at some point. But so does every teacher, mm-hmm. and every administrator. Those are draining jobs. Many of us get weary in well-doing.
Yeah.
You do not. It is a marathon, not a sprint. Mm-hmm. And so the results are, you know, when you're building foundations, Christ tells us the wise man builds their house on a rock, a fool builds it on the sand. Well, the houses look very similar. Mm-hmm. And so it is quite frustrating when you think, well, we're trying to do all of this stuff to build a house on a rock. What looks very similar to this child over here whose house has obviously been built, you know, without all of these, you know, without the wisdom and virtue mm-hmm. elements, the you know, that we're trying to build into our students. But when the storms come, then the foundations are revealed. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what teachers and administrators have to cling to, is we believe, especially in a classical Christian methodology, because we believe it prepares them for the storm. Mm-hmm. And their foundation is different, and they can handle the storm, obviously, with the strength that Christ gives them. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think you see the big difference. Mm-hmm. And that's where it's not everybody is the same. God's very clear about it. He won't be mocked. Ultimately, what you sow, you reap.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, Mark, what a tremendous experience and how instructive it is. One last question, though, about this race. The gentleman who came out for those last 3 miles, who cheered for you and led you to the finish line and then disappeared, what have you thought about him over the years, and what ways has he instructed you?
Well, one of the main lessons I learned from him is the impact you might have on someone else that is ongoing. Hmm. All of us as in education love to get the letters from students who say, hey, you may never have known this, mm-hmm. but when you said this in class, this happened, and I've never been the same. Mm. Or when you actually stayed after, or you actually came to my ball games, or you actually, I was sick, and instead of saying, "Oh, you're missing another day," you dropped by the house mm-hmm. and had a meal, or you had whatever. Mm-hmm. I just need you to know that changed everything for me. Mm. And so this man doesn't know what that did for me. Mm. He doesn't know what that story, you know, I tell grandparents 5 years ago, I told our grandparents, I may do it again this year because a lot of them have asked again. I told them this marathon story, mm-hmm. and for them, I'm trying, you know, they're on both sides as well. They're the encouragers. I tell them their grandkids stand on their shoulders, and they'll only be as strong as those shoulders are. That's why God calls us to remember. But also, I tell them, I can't tell you how much it meant when that young lady looked at me and said, "You won." Mm-hmm. And it's worth the race, and it's worth the fight, and we want to be with Paul when he says, "I fought the good fight and finished the course, and I've kept the faith." Mm-hmm. And so keeping the faith is not an individual mm-hmm. Pursuit. If it is, Satan wins, because no man's an island, and Satan's been doing this for thousands of years, and we are pretty helpless. Mm-hmm. It is obviously with the Lord who gives us the ultimate strength, but he puts fellow pilgrims on the race with us. Mm. And I think what that man showed me is he didn't have to have any glory. I don't know his name. I wouldn't know what he looked like. Everything was blurry by that point. I just know he was a lot skinnier than I was. but what I do know was the man sacrificed his time. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's huge, and what a parallel. Mm-hmm. His time was precious. I mean, I don't know how many marathons he's run, but he would have been there easily 10, 15 minutes, you know, probably more ahead. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't what was important to him. Yeah. What was important to him was somebody else.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's going to cost you your time mm-hmm. and your energy, your strength, your finances, mm-hmm. you know, but it's because you believe in something greater. And again, you're trying to form the who. Mm-hmm. You're trying to shape people that are already formed in the image of God so they have value, but you're trying to shape them into being the kind of man or woman that God is wanting them to be. Mm-hmm. And that's going to take a little extra, and that's going to take a lot of sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And so that man showed me that sacrifice is necessary. And you don't have to get any pat on the back or get any glory. I didn't thank him one time. Hmm. And again, so I'm sure he's never heard my story, mm-hmm. But I wish he would. Mm-hmm. But I hope he's a believer. I hope one day in glory I can grab him and say, "Hey, buddy, you're the man, and you changed my life." Hmm. And because of that race, that gave me a whole different view on who I was and who God intended me to be. And I was able to share the lessons learned with many along the way. Mm.
Well, Mark Guthrie, thank you very much for sharing this experience and also through it, your sense of what it means to be involved leading and forming children and leading a school as well at Caldwell Academy there in North Carolina. If someone wanted to get in touch with you, Mark, via email, would you be open to that? Would you be willing to share your email? I'm sure there's a lot of young administrators and principals and educators who might enjoy corresponding with you.
I would be honored to talk to anyone. I would learn probably as much or more from them as they ever would from me. But I would absolutely. Can I give you my email address?
Yes,
is that
please.
Okay? My email address is just mark.guthrie, and Guthrie is Guthrie. @CaldwellAcademy.org, and that's like it sounds, Caldwell Academy. And anyone I'd welcome anyone. Every time I have the opportunity to network and correspond with fellow educators, I grow, mm-hmm. and our school is different and it's changed because we learn so much from people that come here to learn, and they leave, I think, more than we give them, because it is a race, and the race requires help all around. And so the different roles come into effect almost every day. And so I would welcome that correspondence.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks for coming on for this interview.
Chris, I appreciate you having me on for the interview, and thanks for all the work that you're doing. And Lord bless you, and so excited to be involved in a very exciting classical Christian movement, and very thrilled to have a lot of partners out there that are, again, shaping the who of the students and forming many godly Renaissance men and women that are already involved in changing this world for Aslan, for the glory of God.
Absolutely.
And that, to me, is a very worthwhile pursuit and worth investing my life.
It's worth the race.
Amen.
Amen. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for your time.